Illustrious.
Hi, I'm Chris Hoffines. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta with the law firm of Casey Gilson. I am a trial attorney. For my sins, I'm also the person in charge of electronic documents and all the various technical aspects of discovery, including forensics.
My name is Jeff Termesazen. I'm also based out of Atlanta. I work for a company that when you call your banks and it says this call may be monitored, it's my software that's monitoring you. The company I work for also works with like TSA, CIA, and that. We do speech analytics. We do wiretapping for the government. We do monitoring of 911 centers, that sort of thing. So every time you hear this call may be monitored, it's usually my things that are doing it. Today we're talking about digital forensics and anti-forensics. We're not getting into it in heavy detail, like the hacking panels will, because there is a lot of detail and there are many, many, many programs, and I don't think all of DragonCon would be long enough to cover them in any sort of detail. So we're gonna give you a sort of basic overview. How many of you are familiar with forensics and anti-forensics? How many of you are very familiar with it? All right, feel free to pipe up. We're gonna be mentioning some things here. Like I said, there are many programs that do everything. So yeah, if you guys, you know, want to add something to it there, please do. This isn't a, here's what is right, here's what is wrong. It's a discussion.
And we are recording this for posterity. So feel free to come up and talk into the mic if you have a question or want to say something so everybody else can hear it. Sounds a little weird when they're talking to themselves.
I have no joke for that, unfortunately. All right. First point is, what are digital forensics and anti-forensics? Essentially, forensics is CSI on your computer, going through finding what's there, especially legal evidence, and on any sort of electronic media, your cell phone, your PDA, to the extent those are different anymore, camera, hard drive, anything like that. Anti-forensics is the defense against forensics. It's the equivalent of running a file down a gun barrel to screw up the ballistics. Or hiding the gun in the first place. I think about these things. So.
All right. A lot of folk and I have aren't sure, you know, they think anti-forensics are illegal. And actually, I suppose it's really in how you use it. How anti-forensics are used can be extremely illegal. And he will speak on that because I'm sure you run into many of those cases.
Extremely illegal.
But in and of themselves, they are actually extremely useful. The common misconception is that, yes, it's illegal and you shouldn't be using them. The truth is, and this is sort of recently starting to come to light more and more, especially in the bigger cons, the security cons, like they're saying, DEF CON, Black Hat, 2005, two authors, and some of you guys may even know these people, James Foster and Vinnie Liu, they came up with essentially nice definitions. And it goes back to what he was saying earlier, where anti-forensics illustrate deficiencies in digital forensic procedures, digital forensic tools, and forensics examiner education. It's no good if you get someone certified to go do forensics and the first thing you do is wipe the hard drive or blow up the cell phone. I know when I started playing with this, for example, the original Blackberries, they've got a battery pack in them, and if you remove the battery pack, your phone's wiped. It's the chips they use are real time, you know, essentially have to have current flowing through them or all the data goes away. The newer ones have got more static RAM in them, so you know, if it turns off, it'll be safe. You can unplug it, swap out batteries and whatnot. The original ones, when we were first playing with them, pop that thing out, it's just clean. You have a nice sparkling new BlackBerry. Very shiny.
A lot of this ends up going to, did I cut you off?
No.
Okay. Well, this goes into the intent you're using it for. I had a friend just out of college. Her job was to hack people's systems to find security vulnerabilities. They paid her to do it, so it was perfectly legal because they weren't going to go after her. But if you do it on your own time, that could be very illegal. Another issue is what we call spoliation of evidence, which is where there's evidence you know that it proves you did something wrong, so you get rid of it, which sounds like a rational thing to do until you realize that the court's response to that is to assume that it proves the worst thing the other side can think of about you. For example, we have a case right now, it's a franchising case, where a bunch of emails have mysteriously disappeared off someone's hard drive. And we think that it proves X. And when it comes around to a spoliation hearing, the court, if they find spoliation, is going to find that, yes, it does prove X, regardless of what the other guy says. So that can be a real problem because the court's response is, we're not going to let you get away with that. Question?
Actually, sit there and tell us, we'll repeat the question here.
Okay.
Does that lead to, I know some companies down where I am in Missouri, they go through wiping.
That, yeah.
Not out of an intent to hide things, yeah. But because it makes it clean, no viruses for the next step.
Yeah, the question is, what if your corporate policy is to destroy, is to wipe the entire system on a regular basis, in that case, nightly. A normal and rational document retention policy is what they're called, even if they're electronic, is not a problem. If you have a valid corporate reason for doing it, to protect against viruses, because you have only so much storage space. But if you all of a sudden change it, that's probably spoliation. If you get what's called litigation hold, which is I'm an attorney, I'm suing a defendant. I send them a letter saying, hello, I'm suing you. Please do not destroy documents about these 12 things. And those 12 things get destroyed in the normal wipe process, that's spoliation. Once you know or reasonably believe that you're getting or about to get sued, you have a responsibility to preserve evidence, even if it's bad for you. Especially if it's bad for you. Yes, sir. Suit. Yeah. Yeah, and that you didn't. You do end up. Oh yeah, you're right. Sorry. The question was, what if someone who doesn't like you deletes evidence for you, in an effort to get you in trouble, essentially, and that's a problem. That could happen. Chances are there's going to be enough fingerprints that the spoliation hearing. Spoliation is actually kind of hard to get because it's such an extreme sanction. So. Could happen, chances are probably won't too often.
That's where forensics comes into play.
Yeah.
Wiping out there, unless they know really what they're doing and know what software to go get, which isn't impossible, deleted things, even formatted drives can be retrieved.
The other thing that's kind of next on our list, which does kind of swing from that is the extent to which the government can search your computer. Unfortunately, this is a moving target right now. A case came down about 2 weeks ago from the Ninth Circuit. The standard had been that the government can search your hard drive at the border if they want to. No probable cause required because it's a condition of entering the United States. That was fairly widely criticized as being a little draconian. And as an attorney, I deal with a lot of confidential documents that I am ethically bound not to release. So I had a real problem with it because if I went across the border and was going to work on vacation or go across working, let's say take a deposition and came back. Spoliation, like spoil. Then the just lost my train of thought. Then I had an ethical obligation to block Homeland Security from looking at my confidential documents to a certain extent.
If you have questions, post them.
Somebody point at it though, so we know to look. A recent case came down. Judge Kaczynski. In the Ninth Circuit, who's the chief judge, actually is considered fairly conservative, even though the Ninth Circuit's considered very liberal, just dropped this opinion out of nowhere. It's in the baseball steroids cases. And he basically tried to create out of nothing a set of guidelines about computer searches. One of them, there is a legal doctrine called the plain view doctrine, which is, for example, I'm a police officer, I'm in hot pursuit, I charge into a house behind a fleeing suspect. In the process of apprehending him, which I'm allowed to do as a cop, I see drugs on the table. Plain view doctrine says, even though I didn't have a warrant, had no probable cause to look for drugs, it was in plain view in the course of legitimate police business, so that evidence would not be excluded. Generally, in the courts, the penalty for a civil rights violation that leads to evidence is the evidence is just excluded. It just doesn't count. So Judge Kaczynski has basically tried to figure out how you can have a computer search and plain view coexist peacefully, and his conclusion was you basically can't. And because what would happen was the police, and they did this in the steroids cases, would go in, map the entire hard drive for 12 files in this case, and then they would find other files in plain view in other directories, in other partitions. So we'll come back to the drive password question. So Judge Kaczynski basically has tried to make the government waive plain view in the case of hearings. The reason everyone's laughing just for the recording is there's stuff being posted on the screen that obviously is not on the sound recording. And then it also says that if you have to do it that way, we map the whole hard drive, a separate division, you know, build a Chinese wall, the separate division has to actually review it, pull out the relevant stuff, ignore the plain view material, and then send the relevant stuff to the investigators. So this is a sea change in the law. Kaczynski's very well respected, but on the other hand, it's one decision, so it may move, it may not.
I have a question on that. What happens if they're just desktop image is something that shouldn't be there? Would that count as plain view?
Yes, because if it's actually on the screen.
Yes.
Yeah, if
like
it's on the screen.
Desktop background.
At that point, the court would probably analogize to a picture on the wall. Functionally, it's the same, and so it would count the same.
I know the Heart of Illinois, one of their standards when they come up on a computer is to take a picture of the desktop, have everything that's on the screen.
Yes.
That's automatically.
You're murderer.
That should be SOP, simply because it is simply there.
The question was, Illinois' standard procedure is to just take a picture of the desktop immediately upon interacting with the computer, and whether that was actually plain view, and probably, yeah. The encrypted drive password question is an interesting question. There's a case called US v. Arnold. I don't have the site. I apologize for that. Where the question was, an individual had intercept information from his ISP that he'd been downloading child pornography. And he had a single large encrypted file on his computer. And he, for reasons I think we can all figure out, refused to give them the password. That was treated as spoliation, essentially. The jury was allowed to infer that encrypted file that he refused to show after they knew he had downloaded pornography, which was illegal, was the illegal pornography. So that's, they can't make you, but it won't do you a whole lot of good. Yes, sir.
Doesn't that have something to do with your freedom to incriminate yourself?
Right, Fifth Amendment.
Question
exactly.
There was, wouldn't it be a Fifth Amendment issue?
Right. The I plead the Fifth. He did. And that's where it got him, was right. It didn't help.
Yeah, the ruling there was actually that border security overrides your Fourth Amendment rights of reasonable search and seizure.
But on the other hand, if they think that you have downloaded trade secrets and in fact you have criminal child pornography, you know, getting nailed on the trade secrets might be better than going to prison. That is one of the balancing tests that a defendant would have to engage in. This is
yes.
Your, oh.
Would there be any ruling about what if they have encrypted files they don't have the key for or the password for?
Right.
So, like, if they're trying to traffic in stolen data and they can't give you the key because they don't actually have the key.
The question was, what if they have an encrypted file but do not have the key, actually physically don't have it, cannot give it up, what happens then? Probably it would come down to what other facts were in context.
Why do you have that file?
that is such a specific question. I'm hesitant to give you a legal answer on it. My gut feeling is that it'll be treated like the child pornography case. If they can track you having received it, and you have an encrypted file, and you can't explain why you have it, you can infer there's a problem. Yes, sir.
What about the border security situation where the guy, he had a computer up with a TSA agent or border control, actually, said, can I look at it? The guy's like, yeah. And look, there was child porn on it. It turned the computer off, and when it turned back on,
it was gone.
The whole thing was encrypted.
Like, that's smooth.
I'm not giving up my password now.
That guy is in trouble because the testimony of the agent that he saw it, and then the fact that
he gave permission.
He gave permission for the agent to look at it. The agent saw it. That evidence is admissible because it was not a Fourth Amendment violation.
The agent saw it, but he can't actually pull it back off the computer now.
Yeah, and then that comes down to the question of the credibility of the agent, and the fact that the whole hard drive is encrypted now. And the guy refuses to give it up would tend to bolster the credibility of the agent when the defendant says, nuh-uh. And the agent can say, yeah, but it's encrypted. Show us. And the jury goes, that would be what happens.
All right, some of the types of forensics. We're not going to go into all of them, just some of the more common ones. One of the big ones that has recently become an issue is for your social media sites, where it is simply not possible to have everything on one system, so they split it all over the place. That's something called cross-drive analysis. And that can get really tricky because you've got little bits of information spread all over the, you know, all over the place, especially in things like Facebook where you may be linking in multiple accounts. You may have some stuff from Facebook, you may be linked to other things on Twitter or your Flickr account, that sort of thing, which you have multiple companies going to multiple drives or multiple servers and possibly multiple jurisdictions, depending exactly where those files are contained. That can be a legal nightmare.
Yeah. Because generally you have to have probable cause for a warrant to go into effect. An interesting question, though, is if you have probable cause for the wrong address on a physical warrant, can you then go serve the right one? Generally not. You have to go get a new warrant. If you have a subpoena for or a warrant for drive, the A drive, but everything's on the Z drive, you have to go back and get a new subpoena. It's a giant pain.
Right. Cryptanalysis, analyzing encryption routines, trying to break them. That's popular. Standard data recovery, recovering deleted files, hard drives, cell phones. I actually recently found a website that you can. It's pretty expensive. I think it's like $300 or $400, but you can buy a nifty little device with a variety of plugs on them, and pretty much any cell phone with a data connection, you pop it in there and it just mirrors that whole thing. It doesn't just mirror the active data, it mirrors everything. So everything that's been deleted and not purged or physically wiped off that disk that it is not recoverable, deleted SMSs, old contacts, everything gets downloaded to that, and it's a little about the size of a self-contained USB stick. The only thing that really stops you is how much data, how fast can you copy all the data off of that phone onto that device. Standard encryption routines then, Windows encryption on there, third-party encryptions like PGP, hidden file and hidden directory. Also ADS. I'm a big fan of ADS for keeping things you don't want others to see secret, like your passwords to your bank accounts and things. I'll get into that in a minute. Standard information technology audit. What is your company doing to safeguard your personal information on there? For that matter, what is your bank doing to safeguard your information? And I can tell you, not a whole lot. They will say a whole lot there. Part of what I do is analyze switch logs. How many of you type your phone number, or type your social security number, or your account number into the phone when you're prompted to? All right. When those folk mail people those logs to look at, it's usually saying clear text. I received a very nice 65 meg log, which had probably 50, 60,000 people's names, addresses, and social security numbers, and credit card numbers. Because what happens is when you type it into the switch logs it, It pulls the information from the mainframe and then sends it to the agent. So when the agent gets, they know who they're talking to, they've got the account information. It's very useful. Problem is when folk like me need to actually see the logs to see why they're not recording those things, that information pretty much comes through as clear text. Now, we do have very strict non-disclosure agreements and other things that we have to sign and stick to make sure that we don't, you know, send that information around. But the particular guy who sent me those log files, had he been here, you'd have had 65,000 names, social security numbers, and addresses up on that board. So if you're sending information like that, encrypt it, send them the password separately. Do not type your information into that phone switch. If you hit zero, it's annoying, but you will get through to an agent. You can give your number across, they'll type into the computer, but it will not go into the phone system at that point. It takes a little bit longer, it's a lot more secure. Then a big one I think you run across a lot of time is folk editing your date and time access on files. Like when was this thing last accessed, when was it created, when was it modified. You get a bunch of programs that go and will change that around. Hackers, the bad sort, are very fond of that for going through and changing things like log file, when the log files were last accessed, what was in there. Because they may go through, get in, wipe the end of the log file, and then readjust all the times that it looks like it's still consistent without any missing data. And then one of my favorites is something called Steg analysis, which is essentially stenography, which is taking data and hiding it in images, which is actually wicked fun to play with. You take your family JPEGs, you take a text file with whatever you want in there, it gets encrypted into the image itself. So you can send that image to your friends and whoever else, and that image, you know, that data will go with it if they know how to retrieve it. It's a very nice way and relatively secure way for trading information with folk securely. I wouldn't really recommend it for like company things, but for personal things, it's a nice, easy way to do it if you just want to have fun with it, you know. And actually, with this thing, and it goes back to the ADS. ADS is something called alternate data streams. How many of you are aware of that term? All right. For those of you who aren't, essentially what it is, it's a secondary file attached to a innocent file. That secondary file may be something bad, like your child porn, or it may be something good, like your bank accounts, passwords, that sort of thing. What's nice about ADS is that it doesn't show up in your hard drive. It doesn't show up in a file listing. If you check the file itself, I usually stick onto text files, that sort of thing, you can actually go in and edit that text file. It will pull up as a text file. Anything you do on it, other than actually run a check to see is this an ADS stream, will show up that this is a standard text file. But you've got a very nice little hidden compartment in that thing that will not appear on the hard drive in any way, shape, or form, that you can stick confidential information into that you don't want others to get a hold of. So I'd recommend folk who want to do that, look into that. Any questions on that? Or do you just... All right. You had anything to add on that?
No, that was all technical.
All right.
But as a good preface, the next section on anti-forensics, physical forensics, I keep checking the screen now. Physical forensics is starting to get a really bad rap. DNA analysis and blood spatter analysis, all the CSI stuff. Because the science behind it's pretty dodgy. I don't know if this is going to splash onto, no pun intended, digital forensics or not. But that's something to keep in mind, is that right now, the physical stuff is actually getting hammered as far as its reliability.
Actually, well, kind of splashing, but in a good way. That goes back to what the guys over at the Black Hat conference were saying, the James Foster and Vinnie Liu, where because hackers and stuff are coming in and trying to break these systems, they have to be so much better. Like you were saying with EtherCAP, the guys who crashed it, someone who's using EtherCAP now has a much better chance of saying, this is a valid program. I know that this is work. The data that I'm providing off of this is secure. If you're, you know, if you're using it for your own purposes, like here, if we get it wrong, it doesn't really matter. If you're trying to hand it off to Chris as part of a court case, you have to be very sure that information cannot be tampered with or has not been tampered with.
Yeah, evidence has to satisfy a bunch of different requirements before it can be admitted. In this case, the ones we're talking about are authentication, which is that the evidence is what it purports to be, So, for example, if I had a picture of the murder scene or the body, then I'd have to actually have a physical person testify that, yes, this is the murder scene. This picture is an accurate representation of that. And without that authentication evidence, it gets struck. It's not any good. So authenticating a digital file will generally require somebody like Jeff, who is an expert, who can actually walk through how he did it and why it is what was on the original computer. And a lot of anti-forensics tends to be trying to break that ability to authenticate a piece of evidence.
It does make, yeah.
Don't they also have to have a process that they use to gather the records? Has to be accepted by the courts as a valid mechanism?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you actually get some very nice programs that do it. I know some folk were mentioning earlier, there's a program called NCASE, which is pretty much considered the industry standard. I don't think it's the official industry standard, but pretty much everyone measures everything else against NCASE. And if you know NCASE well, people will come headhunting you. It's a very good program for that.
The, just have a second. The never mind. Question.
One thing about the NCASE software that I think is amazing is that if somebody challenges it, it's the only one out there right now, that they'll actually come out and sit on the stand and testify as to how the program works.
Yeah, and yeah.
You don't have to know the ins and outs.
Right.
The comment was that NCASE will send somebody out to testify to back up the validity of their program, which reminded me what I was going to say. Thank you. Which is that generally experts have to prove essentially that their methodology has been peer reviewed. In this kind of situation, open source is taking the place of peer review. I don't know if the courts will actually let that one fly. It should, but maybe not. I can see a couple of good ways to attack it. I can see a couple of good ways to defend it. We'll see how that falls out.
Somebody asked, how much does it cost? Your firstborn, your secondborn, your thirdborn.
Yeah, the question is, how much does it? Yeah. The question is, how much does it cost?
Yeah. NCASE starts for the base level package at $9.95. Full enterprise is somewhere around $25,000.
So a full NCASE is $25,000. Just a basic is $995.
Okay. Now, if you have a reason for it, they will send you a free demo, but the demo is locked. They provide you case files, and the software will only read those case files, so you can't bring anything new into it. So if you learn how to use it, you can get a copy without actually having to buy it, but to actually use it outside of the locked examples they give you, yeah, you got to add some major cash.
Yeah, it's not inexpensive enough that if you wanted to play with it and burn it, like you were saying.
Yeah. Right. In that case, just write to them, tell them what you want to use it for. They will usually send you a demo for free. Yes?
Speaking of just like getting something to play with, are there other open source or more free tools that would be the process assemblies of what NCASE do that you could recommend?
No. There are software that does it, but nothing that does it like NCASE does it.
The question was there open source or more affordable software?
A very good place to start with that is to have a look at Backtrack Linux, which is you're familiar with it?
Yeah.
All right. They pretty much got everything that you need in there. The NCASE has really just encapsulated it and set up a standardized way of doing everything. But there's really nothing that they can do that you can't do with a full, you know, with a full Backtrack thing. They just have sort of the reputation and the power behind it to say that, you know, if you're using our stuff, there's no question of validity here. You are good. Unless you purposely screw something up like wiping the hard drive or something, well, they can't help you with that. But yeah, if you guys want to get into this, as a whole, there are innumerable programs and things out there, but Backtrack is a good place to start because it's sort of an all-in-one starting point on that. They've got a website, they've got good documentation, you can download the CD for free. Yeah, and it's a good way to get up and running quickly.
There's another question. Yeah, there was.
Sorry. A couple of other relatively cheap ones. Helix is free. They've still got a free version of it that they have gone to a $210 version. There's also a Windows piece of software called ProWitness.
Called what?
Called ProWitness.
Okay.
They were at the last NCASE conference and they said
I haven't played with it myself, but they said that it does everything NGACE does. It's 144 bucks.
Okay, the comment was there are two other items that you can look at. One was Helix, which is a free version as well as a version for $210. And then another system called ProWitness, which they say will do everything that NCASE does and runs about $150.
Okay, let's tie it to any forensics.
Right, traditionally there are kind of real three kinds, and then there's a fourth one which has recently come out. Your initial three are data hiding, artifact wiping, and trail obfuscation. Data hiding is essentially what it says. You're hiding the data. Encryption, stenography, slack space. Do you guys know what slack space is? All right. So for those of you who don't, what it is, when you guys format your hard drive, it'll give you, say, it'll let you choose like your block size. Let's say you say 64K. Each block of data will then fill up a 64K spot. If you've only got 32K to write to that 64K block, though, you've got 32K open. And there are many millions of these throughout the hard drive. Slack space is that little space there that doesn't really get used. If you're using something in slack space, you can go right to in ADS user slack space, for example. It'll tag it onto those little bits in there, which is why you can't really see it, because other than ADS, it doesn't exist in the system. Something else has got the legitimate use of that block. There's a very nice set of tools from a company called PGP. The full set is pay, but they give it a little, what they call, I think it's Ripper, which is free, that will go through and wipe out your slack space. So you can just run it and let it run. And I think the highest you run is like 49 times, but you're talking like a week to run that. Usually between 3 and 5 is enough on a regular basis to sit and wipe out anything and sitting in the sides there. Yes?
Yeah, also from SIS internals, Microsoft, you can get estimates, but also Windows,
anyway, like that's SIS internals from Microsoft, and it's called S-Delete, and it'll do the same thing there, go through and wipe out your slack space. Good thing to use unless you're using ADS yourself, then be aware of that. Artifact wiping would be simple wiping the hard drive, overwriting it numerous times. The government does that a lot. They'll wipe it 5-6 times using different methodologies. Yes.
How effective is that on flash-based memory as opposed to magnetic media?
It really depends how they're doing it. There's a number of different ways you can write the data, and it depends what the individual thing is using as to how it's wiping it, as to whether it's going to be good or bad.
Scott Moulton is an expert in hard drive forensics and analysis. Gives talks to Black Hat and also law enforcement. He has said that using the secure deletion program to cover write over doesn't work because of the way the wear leveling of the flash devices work.
Right.
And what they found is the safest thing to do is write a continuous stream from dev random or a random data source to your USB drive until the USB drive just fills up. And that forces random data everywhere in the drive. You do that. I've seen anywhere from 2 to 3 up to 7 times in a row, you pretty much wipe the data.
Yes. So straight overwrite.
Yeah.
Now, there is one tool that I do like, which is called Iron Key, which is a hardware-based encryption. It's a USB key, but this has got a little 256 AES encryption chip on there. And if you enter your password 10 times wrong, it'll destroy that chip. And it's a really nice piece of technology. It's fairly expensive, about $200 up for the versions. There's a blank version that the military uses because they don't have any software on there. You get another version which comes preloaded with like Firefox and a couple other things which will actually run off of that drive and not leave a footprint on your physical drive. And there's another one, but I don't know what the other one is. It's like an enterprise version that your company can like administer remotely, that they can enable or disable your password across the network to access the particular drive. But if you guys want secure drives, that I've seen, those are about the most secure at this point. Just don't forget your password, because there's pretty much nothing they can do for you if you do forget it, and that data gets wiped. Thirdly, as far as traditional methods, is trail obfuscation, which would be like log cleaners, misinformation into there, running zombie accounts, There's some software out there that will go and sort of rewrite your log files, what time they were created, what time they were modified, who modified them, that sort of thing. And that's what I love about geeks, is we name things the coolest things. One of the tools is called Transmogrify, which if you're from Calvin and Hobbes, you'll know what that is. So we have awesome naming conventions. And then the one that's relatively new that's coming out is attacks directly on computer forensic software. For example, the first thing you do if you're examining a suspect system would be to clone the hard drive. To make sure that you've got an accurate clone, that you normally use like a hash key to make sure that this is a valid clone. The anti-forensic software will go through and try and mess with that hash key. Because if it doesn't match anymore, then it's likely to get thrown out as tampered evidence there, because your initial says this and the one you're presenting says this, and then you know, well, those don't match, so that's inadmissible.
It's probably a good point to say right now that lawyers generally do not understand technology. Judges generally really don't understand technology. We specialize in another area. We speak Latin. I know enough about hash keys to know that if they're not the same, then the files aren't the same. I don't know enough to get into the technical details, and I'm more knowledgeable than probably 90% of the lawyers out there. So that's kind of the level of opponent, pardon the phrase, that would be being dealt with.
Yes?
I do have a question on the law side of things, just maybe hopelessly naive, and obviously I am not a lawyer.
That's good for you, that you're not a lawyer. Yeah, go ahead.
But my dad is, so I swore I never would be. It seems to me, from the lay perspective, that especially in those cases of child pornography, how can any judge worth the name rule anything incriminating revealing a passphrase? I mean, that seems to be the fourth phrase, I'm sorry. That seems to me to be an open and shut, clear-cut case of the Fifth Amendment. I mean, if you turn over that passphrase, they get that data, you're sunk.
Right.
It seems like that's precisely maybe not precisely, but I guess the Fifth Amendment would prevent people from getting tortured out of them. But it seems like, you know, if that's going to incriminate you, then it's clear.
Well, that's a long question. It was a really good one. The question was, how could a judge who honestly wants to uphold the law, which is their job, could let what we were talking about earlier, the inference of guilt from a suspect in a child pornography case or another case, refusing to divulge the password to an encrypted file? Is that a fair restatement? Well, one, we're dealing with juries, which is its own set of questions. But more accurately, you know, the jury or the fact finder, if it's a judge, has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. All these cases, like the Arnold case that we talked about earlier, there is some indication that there is an illegal file on there. And the correlation of you received an illegal file, there is an encrypted file that's similar, that's a similar size or has a similar creation time. You know, there's some indication that yes, these two are related. A jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt that the illegal file came on, it got encrypted, and that's why the guy's not going to tell us. The other issue going on here is a jury could make that leap. It could be kind of questionable legally, but on appellate review, the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court level, factual determinations like a jury makes or a judge makes as a fact finder are very hard to overturn. They have to be clearly wrong. Whereas a legal determination could be, you made a mistake. You know, that was a close call, but we think it goes the other way. So generally a fact decision like that, even if it's pretty fishy, will generally just survive because we grant so much deference to a jury sitting as a fact finder. As evidence, the evidence that went in was there's an encrypted file. We saw this legal file go on at this time. I don't know, as a matter of fact, whether the fact that the defendant did not give up the password could be admissible. Generally, the fact that you pled the Fifth is not admissible. But if you're asked on the stand and don't say it, it's right there in front of the jury. So yeah, a bunch of stuff that's not individually problematic could add up to what could generally be a real problem Fifth Amendment wise. Yes, sir.
Isn't it analogous to essentially having a lock on a door that if you refuse to give the key to the police, they have the right to cut the lock?
If they have, yeah.
If they have probable cause.
If they have a warrant or, yeah.
Right, and which is the same case if they're looking at a file.
And if they could,
they
yeah.
can't cut the lock.
Right.
So the law is saying, you, if you're innocent, you can reveal the information in there and clear yourself. If not, because we can't cut the lock and look at it,
yeah.
you can infer that.
Yeah, if there was an adamantium door on an impregnable room, the exact same thing would go on. It just would be with a physical piece of evidence. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. It's going to be roundabout, and I hope you follow my thinking on this. Again, with this fictional file on this very probable child molester's computer. Okay. Well, maybe, and you were saying, what if it's trade secrets? Do we trust the defense attorney enough to, or a third party?
No, we'll stick with defense attorney.
We're going to stick with the defense attorney. All right. If he knows what is in that file is illegal, although it's not what you're accusing him of, and he says, okay, I'm not going to give, the prosecutor, I'm not going to give the police this information to see what's on here. I'm telling you, my word's obviously not good enough. You think this is what I've done. If you're going to have a warrant, you're going to say, oh, it is specifically for, you've got three cars. We are looking into this vehicle, So you're looking in that file for this information,
mm-hmm.
but there is that information that he is guilty of. Would that defense attorney, in a situation like that where the person knows they have done something wrong, they just didn't do something?
So your question is a defense attorney obligated to reveal?
Would the defense attorney be able to say, listen, I have seen that file. I know there's no. Okay. Right third.
Defense attorney would not, because of attorney-client confidentiality and because they're a fiduciary of their client. They can't, pardon the phrase, backstab them like that. A third party.
I'm not saying backstab. I'm not saying, listen, this guy's, ripped off his employer. That's what's really in there. Just saying, no, this, or a third party who.
Yeah, a third party would be guided by their own conscience on that. If they knew what was there, they are perfectly free to tell someone, unless there's another reason.
Something else, but I don't want to be convicted of child pornography and have, X amount of years in jail and be on the registry for the rest of my life. But I also don't want to be convicted of embezzlement and have to give you back the umpteen $1 billion.
You may have to choose which one
yeah.
you want to suffer.
Which one? There's just no way around it. If you've done something bad and they're, looking for you, you're going to get.
Yeah, the defendant is given the option of trying to ride it out or picking their poison, and everyone has a downside to it.
I suppose if the defense attorney knows the prosecutor well, they make them some sort of plea agreement.
Yeah, the defense attorney may do things such. I'm saying this very carefully. I don't want to imply one thing. The defense attorney may take a course of action that an intelligent prosecutor can figure out what's going on. The defense attorney is not necessarily doing that on purpose for a in order to communicate. He may honestly just be playing the hand as best he can, but the prosecutor may figure it out. There are also cases where, and some people think it's unethical and it's malpractice, where you do intentionally communicate by virtue of how you're acting. Your kind of law and order thing, and that is at the very best ethically gray. It's probably actionable malpractice. So a defense attorney is in a special spot for that question. But a third party could act however they wanted, unless they had a contractual or other relationship that tied their hands. That was a long question too, but it was good. A couple other hands up.
Got the back.
What TrueCrypt's plausible deniability feature? Jeff.
Can you specify that? Can you go into a bit more on that one?
Sure. TrueCrypt makes an encrypted drive on as a file on your computer, and has a feature that allows you to hide a drive inside your encrypted volume. So therefore, if someone were forcing to reveal a password, you could reveal the password to the outer volume and not the hidden volume inside. And because those supposed to be able to distinguish the data frame a bit or distinguish between a normal drive and a
file. Are you asking technically or are you asking legally? Because technically, if someone's doing it, the first thing that you would do if you're not sure, you'd go talk to the company and say, hey, how does this work? I've got a case here where I'm examining some of your software. What happens? They will probably tell you, hey, there may be a hidden volume here, so you know to go look for it. And often if it's a legal case, you know, I may go say, hey, I've got a warrant here that says I need to get this information. Can you help me out? And companies will often help you because, I mean, you know, they have a reputation. We're helpful to law enforcement. And they will say, well, we don't know how to unencrypt it, but here's how you check to see if there is information here.
Except TrueCrypt is not a commercial package, it's open source.
Yeah, and again, there is nothing.
Well, what I do then is you basically talk to the guys who wrote it. You know, it wouldn't have to be the company, basically the developers. Whether it be a company or open source, you simply go to them and say, or if you're good enough with code yourself, go read through it yourself and see what's going on, but it's depending on how big and how complex it is, it's often easier to go ask the developers for their help because they know exactly how they put it together, and they may well know a way to get that information out, possibly not unencrypted, but at least give very definite evidence. And again, this goes back to me as a forensic investigator going and say, hey, I think there's information here, which then brings my credibility into play when I present it to him, or going to the developers and being able to say, right, the developers who wrote the software are able to come and say, there is data here. On a legal side, they're gonna have a lot more credibility as the developers than I will as a straight forensic investigator. I would work with them to get that. But you know, if I'm trying to build a case for him to take to court, I'm trying to get as credible and as detailed and as secure information that to, well, depending on which side he's on, that his opponent won't be able to bring anything into question. Or if there is a question that you can successfully argue that you are more correct than whatever reasonable doubt they're trying to bring into it is.
The other issue, which may or may not answer a question you had, is that as an attorney, I am ethically required not to suborn the judicial process, specifically perjury. So to the extent that I know that the second deeper file is there, or deeper encryption, I guess, being more accurate, the fact that when you start answering questions at deposition or at trial, and if your answers start drifting into convenient but not true, then I have an obligation to stand up, even though you're my client, and either shut you down or at extreme inform the other side that perjury is going on. But if you then don't tell your attorney to avoid that, your attorney doesn't know everything, which one makes us kind of hacked off. But two means that we can't give you the best service because we don't know all the facts. It might work if it all went right, but it can be kind of a dangerous game. Got a couple other hands up.
Based on a real life scenario, we had an employee who was being let go, and the standard corporate policy is to employees escorted away from the desk, and I, as IT director, come and hear their ear while quickly checking the laptop to see if there's anything personal that's burned to a DVD and hand him on his way out the door. I found an additional internal hard drive had been added to the laptop, which apparently was blank, so I let him walk out with it, not realizing later he had installed third party encryption software. From a legal standpoint, would it have been within the company's rights to say that internal hard drives were plugged into a corporate asset, we have to assume it belonged to the corporation?
That's a really good question. The question was an individual who was involuntarily terminated one way or the other had a company laptop that he had on his own added a second hard drive to. Turns out it had been encrypted, possibly. Would the corporation have had the legal right to take it and examine it? The first question, it's the least satisfying one. It depends on what the employment agreement was. A good employment agreement would give you the ability to deal with that. However, it's such a novel situation, only arising in the past couple of years, that what would most likely occur is that he would This is interesting. This is kind of close. I think this is a close call. I think what would come down to was you would be stuck having to sue him in tort for whatever damage he did with that. To the extent you had trade secrets, especially if you were for a Georgia corporation, trade secrets are protected a different way, and they're much stronger in Georgia because of the Coke formula. So you have some extra guns with that. But it's very interesting.
Two guys who know the data.
Yeah, it's actually very, very interesting that copyright, patent, trademark, not trademark necessarily, all have a limited term. Trade secret can last forever, at least in Georgia. So, yay Coke. over the side.
Going back to the TrueCrypt question, there is, I looked at a friend of mine, they have registry keys that show when the USB device was put on, and their registry keys also show which drive were on the device. From there, you can determine how many drives are available on the device, and that would enable you to at least realize that there was more data there than what you had.
That's a good point. Jeff might have spotted that. I never would have in a million years. And again, when you're dealing with lawyers, we have a very shallow understanding, and it all relates to how this deals with the law, not necessarily how it works.
I'll say this, I am paranoid about things like that. So I don't do anything that I don't have someone else check, simply because it's too easy to overlook something stupid and have the, you know, more so for a legal thing, simply because there is so, you know, much more tricky. But if you're someone trying to recover data from someone, it's less of an issue. But if it's for a legal thing, yeah, you want to cover yourself as many ways as possible. Even if the other person goes back and says, you know what, you didn't miss anything, I can concur with you 100%. It's like, great. There's a second opinion there from, you know, someone else who can verify that you didn't screw something up.
Way at the back.
About the second hidden internal hard drive, actually just be more prudent for the company to hold on to it and make the terminated employee sue them and take them to court to try to get it back.
That's a good point. A corporation may not want to alienate the rest of the employees by deciding to be that heavy-handed, but they may if it's important enough.
Well, I mean, if they fear the loss of confidential information,
Yeah, I mean, lawyers are just mercenaries who you know, it's literally Sun Tzu's, not Sun Tzu, Clausewitz's, you know, politics by other means. We pursue corporate policy by other means, but we don't set corporate policy. But that's a good point. That was an option. Yeah.
Is that technological ignorance recognized as a problem throughout the legal community? And are steps being taken to correct it? And tangentially, I've also heard it said that lawyers have an awful lot of problems with statistics and misinterpreting that. That's another problem.
Yeah, the joke is that you become a lawyer because you can't handle math and science. And there's a lot of truth to that.
Well, I hope you don't ever fix it, because if you do, a lot of us will be out of work. Stay stupid.
The other problem is that... I forgot what I was going to say.
Check the board.
I actually did forget what I was going to say now. The question was, does the legal community recognize that there is a knowledge deficit and they're trying to fix it? And no, because lawyers are very specialized. We spend a lot of time developing a set of skills that are basically all revolve around the legal system. You know, we are a hammer. We don't want to deal with screws and screwdrivers and stuff like that. That's why we have outside experts. And to the extent that it's a crippling problem, my understanding is a lot of lawyers are learning at least enough to not be a complete idiot. And as younger lawyers are coming in, we just know better. We've grown up with it. I'm a 1978 birth date. I'm probably one of the last 2 to 5 years of birth dates that is just not inherently comfortable with technology. You know, I'm much more comfortable than my boss, who's only 5 years older than me. So we do know it's there. We do deal with it when we have to, but there is a definite feeling that Anything more than enough to do the legal work is specializing the wrong way. We should be specializing as lawyers, not as hackers.
Wouldn't it also be dangerous because they could take your credibility? Like they can't really argue if you're a lawyer because you know you've passed the bar, but if you're coming up with,
as far as you know, I did. Really, I did. You can look it up. My knowledge of computer systems is useful deposing a computer expert. It's useful getting evidence into court. I don't really do any of the analysis myself a whole lot. I do some when I have to. But also remember that, you know, I am a six-year associate, so I'm a senior associate, but associate is the lowest rung of lawyers. And I'm charging between $150 and $200 an hour. And that is actually kind of cheap, truth be told. A first-year associate, a cheap one is $90 to $110 an hour. Do you really want to pay that when you don't have to? So it's not cost-effective for the client. My high-end rate is higher, by the way, just in case that affects anybody. Yeah.
I have seen one case of a friend of mine, a forensic expert out in California, where he was actually hired by the judge to advise the judge about technical aspects of
yes.
forensics because they were dealing with two insurance companies that were coming in. Technical arguments that the judge couldn't even begin to recognize.
Right.
There are some people who are beginning to recognize that they don't have that level, but so far, I think they're
feeling more. Yeah, the parties can bring expert witnesses. The court can also appoint an expert and take testimony or just have an advisor, like the question comment mentioned. Yes, judges are not stupid. I mean, judges are probably the top 10%. All of them are probably top 10% of the lawyers. Lawyers generally actually have higher IQs. I'm not saying you're not smarter in the country. So judges really are not stupid by and large, you know. Backwoods Georgia judges being the exception, honestly. And what are you doing there to get sued in the first place? So.
Yes, back. Speak up a bit.
Okay, I don't know if you covered this before, but with possession of these tools, if I can tie intent,
Spoliation.
All right. The question was basically what we went back to, is having these tools illegal? And the answer is no. It's entirely on how you use it. If you use it to do bad things, yes, it's illegal. If you use it to keep your usernames and passwords safe and that sort of thing, it's perfectly legal.
The fact that you've got one of those tools and emails have mysteriously disappeared that could be relevant, that can go in the hopper as far as people thinking about whether you did, in fact, spoliate. Just checking.
Yes.
As an extension to that question, how does the whole Homeland Security and war against terrorism that amplify that problem when people are much more paranoid, governmentally much more paranoid about people having the ability to encrypt things or hide things? You know, kind of similar to what happened in the park here. You know, they kind of looked at the friends you know, so what happened to that happened to them.
Well, the CDMA, the Copyright Digital Millennium Act, is that right?
Yeah.
Does criminalize you know breaking copy protection, and so there's the movements in copyright, but not necessarily in Homeland Security. If you have something whose sole purpose is to, if you have an actual computer virus that happens to do something beneficial or neutral, like wipe your hard drive. That could be a problem, but having the tool is generally not an issue, but it could be. You know, legislation could.
Say, come out with encryption technology twice as robust as the existing one.
Actually, the government probably licensed to you, you'd be very rich.
Yeah, there's that.
The government come after you and say, we want to know how you did that. Because I know we had that same thing with our speech analytics software. And the CIA wanted our routines to decrypt so that they could do their own work on the software. And we were like, nope, can't have that. It's ours. We're not licensing it. You can buy the software from us, and we'll work with you. but we're not selling you those routines and stuff. And they got very upset, but in the end, they had to come to us when their drives get screwed up on something, they've got to come over and decrypt it, have to bring those drives into us. And we have had agents sitting in the offices, you know, armed agents, and we're like, hey, we're going to lunch, you want to come with? He says, nope, that hard drive can't leave my site. So, yeah, it is legal.
For some of the people in here who are not professional information security, there's been some changes in the laws recently, the last year or so, or 2 years, where for cases like Enron, as a matter of fact, where they changed the rules on what kind of searches you're required to do to dredge up evidence for the discovery process. And that process can be extremely expensive. If you're a large corporation with multiple sites, lots of mail servers, it can be a crippling expense to a corporation.
Yeah, the comment, I'm going to expand on it, actually, because this is one of my areas of expertise, more so even than digital forensics. The comment was about how if you're a large corporation, the rules on discovery. Discovery is different from evidence, because the United States favors extremely expansive discovery. We're very unusual in the world. And discovery is I've sued you, now give me all of your relevant documents. I will pick and choose which ones I want to introduce at trial. There's a case called the Zubilee case. There's actually five of them. This is the second one, which talks about what, in the event of electronic data, you have to produce. And because the issue was, I think it was Citibank, had a bunch of legacy systems that had old emails, but they might be relevant to this employment case. And they were saying it would cost millions of dollars per spool to actually decompress these and produce them. And so the standard essentially is, if it is easily accessible to your system, you must produce it. If it is not easily accessible, so anything in your Outlook inbox or on your server or on a mainframe, if you still have one, that's all discoverable. If it's in a legacy system, if it is on offsite storage, for example, disaster proofing, that stuff is not necessarily not discoverable. It can be either, if you can prove extreme need or you're willing to pay for it, you can force the other side to dig those things out and produce off of them. But it can be, you know, but the fact that it is expensive is not enough to not produce. The fact that it is hard to do, irrespective of cost, is what that touchstone is.
So basically what you want to do as part of your corporate IT document management is to encrypt everything and ship them off to Alaska.
Yes. As part of your IT, you do want to, if you are thinking about litigation a lot, you do want to make a lot of documents very inaccessible. If the judge figures out that's your policy, you are maybe going to jail. But that was kind of stupid. But more accurately, if the judge, you're probably going to be paying a gigantic fine and paying to ship them all back from Alaska and produce them. You're definitely doing that. If the judge is having a bad day, you are going to jail. Because that's just, they don't want to put up with that from anybody. Yeah. Yeah, Keith.
Yeah, because of this very issue, data retention policies become a very big deal. The idea is they're saying, well, to avoid the risk of that potential expense, keeping the data around because there might be some information that's valuable to us is less valuable than the potential risk of a lawsuit and the cost of recovering the data.
Right.
We're going to start a retention policy of automatically deleting data older than X. And by doing that, you fall into what you said at the beginning, that as long as the request
right, because you were just doing your normal thing.
Right.
But
it reduced your cross-section risk. Think of this being in a gunfight, and instead of standing square, I crouch behind a chair and get small.
And bear in mind, in the Zubilee case, I think her claim was worth $5 million. It wasn't a whole lot of money, as things go. They spent more than that on document discovery. You know, they could have settled for the full amount and spent less money. So that's if you're an IT person for a corporation, that's something to really think about is your exposure financially to cooperating and to not cooperating.
As far as digital forensics goes, are there any nationally recognized or respected certification programs to become a forensic analyst?
There are, but each side's got its fans. I'm working on one right now called the CHFI, the Certified Hacking Forensic Investigator. They claim it's a standard. I think it's good training. I would say you probably will find, you know, depending on who you talk to, just go for as many as you can.
From a legal point of view, if you're trying to be somebody who is acknowledged as an expert witness or anything with hacking in the name is probably not going to give you any credibility.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, think about that going forward, that people who are your grandmother or your mom are going to be on that jury and are going to hear that certification. So
usually something there would be get the certification, then hook up with a particular institute that's known for something like that, like law investigation service, something like that, because then they will pay more attention to who you're working for and the reputation of that than your particular qualifications. Those will still come into play, but, you know, it's, if I'm working as a private person, I say, hey, I've got a, you know, I'm a forensic hacking investigator, and they're going to go, all right. But if you go, hey, you know, I'm a forensic investigator working for a company that is exclusively licensed to work with the FBI, CIA, TSA, they're going to go, well, if those guys are okay with you, you know, we'll probably cut you some more slack than if you just come off the street with that same thing. So it's, a lot of it is not really what you know, but who you work with in that particular case.
And a good lawyer will soften that coming out if you do have not that much of a track record.
Now, you do have exceptions. You know, you've got folk who can stand up and say, I'm a hacker, and people will still go, you know what, we want you working for us. I mean, DEF CON, Black Hat is full of folk like that, that, you know, they don't really care what certifications you've got, just because these guys have the reputations that if you say their names, everyone knows who they are, and everyone goes, all right, you know, you're good. They may still try and attack it, but there's just so much information around that particular person that it's almost impossible to discount them as an expert witness.
Way at the back. Oh, never mind that.
All right, we're pretty much at time anyway, so are there any... Okay, any other questions? All right, yeah.
Okay.
In a criminal case, how much is the prosecution in terms of forensics has to put forward? I mean, I've looked at the case file as one federal case, and it really... And I'm not a forensics guy, but it did not seem that the hard data supported the interpretation of the data that they were making.
How much does the prosecutor in a criminal case have to put forward as far as evidence backing up the reliability of the data?
In terms of the forensics?
Not a whole lot. The point of it having an expert is that person does all the heavy lifting intellectually and just tells you the conclusion, tells the jury the conclusion, and you rely on the expert's expertise. But as a general rule with an expert, I put out enough information to qualify them as an expert, which is its own little process, and then I will say, what did you find out and why? And that why is pretty surface level, and if I need to dig in any farther, I will, but I try not to. The more information they give out, the easier they are to attack on cross.
Specifically going in, like, before you have to make it to trial, like when...
Prosecution has to disclose essentially all their evidence to the defense in a criminal trial. That's one of the due process protections. So, in the case of an expert report, I'm not 100% sure on criminal, but I believe they just have to disclose the report and any articles or papers that are supporting it, which are not publicly available. So if the guy is halfway through his book and relied on chapter one, then they have to produce that because it's not publicly available.
Anything else? All right. You have anything else?
I'm good. Is there any other questions?
Thanks, guys, for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate you guys.